I'd like to take a moment to tell you about Entertainment Earth. They carry tens of thousands of licensed products covering everything from Power Rangers to Pokemon, Ultraman to Iron Man, and for RangerCast listeners, you can get 10% off your order and free shipping on any order, $79 and up. Just go to ee.toys/ranger. That's ee.toys/ranger. Or click the link in our show notes. RangerCast may receive a commission from your purchase. This is RangerCast, episode 34, an interview with Joshua Moore, the author of More Phenomenal, How the Power Rangers Conquer the World. Recorded on Monday, May 12, 2025. Welcome, welcome. It's Tyler, better known as Real Volto. And with me, I have a very special guest. I've been trying to get him on for the longest time, Joshua Moore. You may know him out there in the Twitterverse as Kentucky Jam. He's been a fan of Power Rangers all his life, since 1993. You can literally say he's been watching it since he was in diapers. Over the last decade, he's written about sports, business, COVID, movies, video games, and yes, Power Rangers, for his hometown paper, the Lexington Herald Leader, as well as for fan websites like Ranger Command Power Hour. He runs the Ranger Reader newsletter on Substack. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it so much, Tyler. You guys, obviously, tremendous friend in the community to this book, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit.
Yeah, the book is more phenomenal, and I do want the literally the title, More Phenomenal, but the book is too. And I want to disclose up front that I was interviewed for the book. I contributed a photo, and I also looked over the manuscript. So, Josh, first tell us, like, what's the elevator pitch? Tell us what the book goes into.
Yeah, anybody. So it's basically, my one-line version, if you're familiar with this book, is I like to tell people, it's Seinfeldia for Power Rangers. If you're familiar, if you're a Seinfeld fan, you might have encountered the book Seinfeldia. It was a New York Times bestseller, so I only bring that up because it was a pretty popular book. And it's by Jennifer K. Armstrong, who was somebody that her resources were kind of a lot of things that I leaned on in terms of getting this together and trying to figure out how I wanted to go about, and if I wanted to go about doing something like this. And it's essentially just a history. It's a narrative history. So that's just, kind of it's facts. It's ultimately a big piece of journalism. It just takes the form of a long story, kind of telling the story of Power Rangers. You start back at the beginning and to where we are now, which for something like Power Rangers, which is constantly, there's always constantly something happening with a franchise like Power Rangers. So you can't. That's when you get into the end of the book. That's where you kind of have, you got to flex a little bit of creativity. Like, how do you close? How do you wrap up something like that? Especially right. In the period of time where the book was being written, there's a lot of tumult around Power Rangers. So
we're going to get to some of that later. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's essentially what it is. So.
So what led you to want to write this book, and what did you think made you the right person to write it?
Yeah, I was reading, I'm a beach reader, that's kind of where I do my best reading, and it was the year after, well, it was still during the COVID-19 pandemic, but it was 2021, about over a year into it. I went to the beach with some friends, my now wife. We were just dating at the time, but my now wife, and took a book with me, Claire McNear's Answers in the Form of Questions. It's about Jeopardy. It's a similar thing to what I was talking about with Seinfeldia, and that's actually how I stumbled into Jennifer's work was through Claire had been on podcasts and stuff, and one of those was something that she did with Jennifer and another woman, Kimberly Potts, who wrote a similar book about the Brady Bunch. So all these women kind of really helped informed more phenomenal, to say at least, just in terms of kind of opening my mind to this type of work. Not that I hadn't read books about TV before. I was a big fan of not so much TV, I guess, but James, you're probably familiar with James Andrew Miller's work, Tyler. I know you're a sports guy. He did.
Not so much.
He He did the SNL book. It was like an oral history of SNL. I think it's
Oh, yeah, I think I've heard of that book. Like,
yeah,
it
it's
informed the movie Saturday Night, if I'm not
yeah, I
mistaken,
think
right?
it was a pretty big basis for the movie, at least the early part of the book. And he also did a similar book for ESPN. It's called Those Guys Have All the Fun. So that was probably my earliest thing interacting with that, with this. But his are oral histories, and the differences between an oral history and what I've written and what the women I was talking about wrote, it is more of like a long article. It's sort of how you can kind of think about it. Whereas an oral history is, it's sort of written in a way where the speakers of the book are, you're taking old quotes or interviews that you've done and piecing them together that way, and then filling in the gaps. This is more, if you're someone who likes to read, it's more of a traditional book.
Now, you've talked about this a little bit out there, but tell us about the challenge of trying to get a publisher to take it on.
Well, nothing's ever easy with Power Rangers. That's something that's certainly the case. But yeah, so you mentioned I'm most predominantly a sports writer based out of Lexington, Kentucky, which is it's a decently sized city, but it's not a major city. Even Louisville, our biggest city, it's about an hour east of Louisville. Even Louisville isn't what most people consider a major city. It's sort of borderline. And so that's I'm starting from that point of reference for people when you're going out and pitching. It's something that, they're looking for your platform, especially for a book like this. It's different if you're writing a work of fiction. They're going to look at it and maybe, platform still matters, but they're also going to look for, like, is this something marketable, or something that's kind of trendy, like it's part of the trends. For a work of nonfiction, it's a lot about your platform, and your expertise, and kind of why you're the right person to marry to this content. For me, I'm a sports writer, a college sports writer, and so it's I'm asking you, but so my whole process, basically, the first thing you have to do for pitching something like this is just to prove why you're the right person. So you tell that story. You're basically telling a story about yourself as much as you are, why this is something worth writing about. And the thing I kept running into early on was I just couldn't even get an agent to even, reach out back to me and tell me thanks, but no thanks. I probably threw the, I threw until I found an agent about 18 months into the process, I probably only got three rejections out of like 300 probably plus people that I reached out to, and that's crafting like, emails, and it's all an email thing, and using tools that are in that industry that you kind of use to find those. And but you're kind of personalizing them because you can look at what agents like and the kind of things they're looking for. So you're not just I'm not just like shooting darts into the to a, in a blind spot. You're looking at people who like nonfiction, who might want nonfiction about TV shows. It's very, you get pretty it can get pretty granular.
Yeah, it's tough, and sometimes you need luck. Like, I have a friend who just published a book of essays, but if it wasn't for an essay she wrote on Gawker after the riots here, she would never have gotten noticed, or maybe it would have taken longer.
Yeah, totally. And that's, and that's a good that's good to bring up, because yeah, if you've written for something that all it takes is really just at the end of the day, it does take one person to kind of believe in you, and that's for anything, but especially for something like this. And so when I connected with my agent, his name's Mark Falcon, he on his bio for his website, he'd mentioned that he was really he's kind of an advocate for. He's a horror writer himself, but he also he does agency. He worked in the music industry for a while, so he's kind of had an eclectic background. So that for me was one. That was kind of a thing. He's like, okay, I've got kind of an eclectic background, so me and this guy are a little similar. And he also was looking for stuff that might appeal to men. He wants boys to read. He thinks men. He actually something specific. It was like he on his website. I wish I'd checked it before we got on the call. He said something. He wrote. He has something listed like, if you write fiction that isn't set in World War II, like because he's kind of broadened the horizons, the literary horizons. So I sent him an email. This was like the last wave of emails I sent before I decided if I don't get anybody to buy it this time, I'm gonna sit on it for a year or two because I had a kid on the way, and he, in my email I said like this isn't fiction, but You know, I think it's kind of hitting that audience that you might want to try to reach. I understand, you know, if you don't like it, cool, but, you know, I think this is something you might, you know, be interested in. And 45 minutes later, he emailed me and said, can you hop on a call tomorrow? And we hopped on a call, talked for about 45 minutes or something, and we were both on the same page, and he started shopping around to publishers. And then that's, and then you go through the whole thing again with publishers, except it's a lot faster. Because you go to the major ones first, and they kick back and say, they have their things they say about it. One of them was like, I think this story was told in the Toys That Made Us, which is, you know, if you're a Power Rangers fan, you know, I mean, it's a pretty well produced episode of TV, but you know, it isn't any begin to scratch the surface of the Power Rangers story, as in the way that, you know, I was trying to do it, you know, present really this is everything kind of crazy that's happened around this show over the course of 30 years. And so we landed with Applause Books, who at the time was an imprint of Roman and Littlefield, an academic publisher, and it based in America. But in the time since I've been working and getting to publication, they were acquired by Bloomsbury, which is a slightly bigger independent publisher, but they're based out of the UK, than Roman and Littlefield. So it was a good thing for the book. It's kind of created some, that's like part of the reason the book at some point was supposed to come out in April. And that was part of some of that, it's kind of screwed that up a little bit. But it's all for the better. I mean, it's ultimately better for the book that it's with a bigger publisher that has more distribution and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the research process. Remind me, how long did the book take from start to when you had, had a full book ready for people to read?
Yeah, so in that 18-month period where I was still pitching to agents, so by the time I'd reached the point where I had a proposal together, it was 20... I started throwing that out around the start of 2022 was when I actually started contacting agents. But in that 6-month period between when I'd kind of decided I wanted to do it in the summer of 2021 until when I started pitching, you know, I had to put together the proposal. So that includes like having to write a little bit. And so for that, I could write enough just based off old material, like existing material, you know, stuff you can find in newspapers. I've kind of had the fortune of having interviewed some people, just as part of the course of my life a little bit. So that helped a little bit, but also I started reaching out to people kind of cold emailing people saying, hey, this is something I'm doing. I'm trying to pitch and I'm transparent. You know, I'm saying, this might never amount to anything, but you know, it's something I want to do. I think Power Rangers is a deserving property, you know, to have this kind of work produced about it, you know, something that really brings in people and really informs them about this show. And so through that, you kind of start making connections and people start sending you emails of other people. And so by the time that I actually got a book deal, I hadn't interviewed everybody, but I either had interviewed probably about 70%, 60 to 70% of the people that were interviewed for the book, and then and had contacts for pretty much almost all the other people that I was planning to interview or wanted to interview and was just trying to get a hold of. So a lot, and then all that other time you're digging through newspaper clippings, I was buying TV guides. I bought every TV guide that had a significant Power Ranger story in it off eBay, which is kind of funny because I don't think I even ended up using any of the material from those in the book proper. So they're not, I think they're site listed in the bibliography because I ultimately didn't end up tapping them for anything. Because really, so maybe they are, I don't remember, but I bought a book. I can't remember the guy's name, and it's fine because the book's trash, but it's like an old, Satanic Panic book, just all about Power Rangers. So that one's kind of funky. So just stuff like that, you know, and digging, you know, I'm rewatching the show too, doing a lot of that, but that's something like I would have been doing that anyway, you know? So,
yeah, you've been posting some content, related to the interviews you've done. We're posting that content on Ranger Reader, and I've been, you know, really impressed by the breadth of the interviews that you were able to do. Like Greg Bullock doesn't go to cons or anything like that. He's very much off the grid, but You got to talk to him for like an hour. What were some of the interviews that you were like the biggest gets for you in this book?
Greg's one of them just because, not so much because his interview and what he had to say, and even his character. It's not, ultimately, Lieutenant Stone isn't really, he's an important character to us as fans, but in the terms of the story I'm telling, he's not really somebody that matters a
True.
great deal. But he mattered to me because it's like no one's ever talked to this guy, like it's so that was pretty cool. Just in a sense of that, Margaret Lesh was great, and she was someone I connected with really early on. She, if you're someone listening that doesn't know, she was the president of Fox Kids Network when she's the woman who greenlit Power Rangers. She's the woman who doesn't get enough credit, I think, for her role in making sure that it's Earth in the story of Power Rangers, because Haim Saban.
Even before Power Rangers.
Yeah, she was 10 years before Haim and her connected, and it finally happened. She and Stan Lee were trying to get it off the ground through Marvel and the relationship they had over there with Toei. So it's just an incredible. She was incredible, and she's just the kindest woman, and she's someone I've stayed in touch with throughout the entire process. She was sending me photos pretty late in the game when that kind of started coming together, and just a really incredibly nice lady. So getting her, and she was really early. She was like, there's over 100 interviews, people that I interviewed, and she was like six or seven. Like, she was really early on in the process, and honestly, the first few chapters, so much of the first few chapters are informed. When you write something like this, you're trying to take as many perspectives as you can on the same events and figure out kind of what the most narratively, like how to write about that. But her voice is in there a lot because, I mean, she is such an important figure, and she's just a great quote. I mean, she has a lot
Oh
of good
yeah.
insight.
Who are other people who are featured in the book who fans will be really happy to hear from?
Yeah, I think Anne Austin's another one that I was really happy to connect with. And there's a funny story about her. I initially called her out of the blue one day, and I don't usually do that. I almost always am an email first person, but I'd found her number through some various means. There's a lot of ways to find people's contacts if you know what you're doing as a journalist, and so I called her. I don't know what possessed me to do it, but I called her out of the blue, and she picked up. And was kind of just taken completely aback, like she didn't really understand what was happening. And I actually think she might have been in the middle of a meeting or something, or a Zoom call or something too. So, and I was like, oh man, I have blown this, and this is such an important person that I wanted to connect with. And so I followed up with emails a couple times and never heard back. And finally, at some point, like almost 6 months after that, I circled back again and kind of I sent another follow-up email, and I was like, hey, Ann, you might remember, like, I was this rando guy who, it was after I'd got the book deal, because at the point when I'd reached out to her, I hadn't had the deal in place. So I'm like, okay, here's what's happened since, I cold called you and, just came off like a dumbass. And it was great, and she was fantastic. She couldn't have been kinder too once we connected. So that was really awesome. She's someone, because she's one of these people that doesn't go to cons a whole lot or anything. And asked her, I got to talk to her about some things that she's never really talked about, which is what I really tried to do with a lot of people. Especially if you're somebody who either doesn't talk a lot or, you're far removed from events that have maybe happened that might be controversial or things that might have rubbed you the wrong way. I think that's the great thing about something like this is, especially now, like, because we get to a place where Power Rangers is, more or less canceled by the end of the book. Everybody that's related to the show has some their stake in it. It's not, they're not trying to burn bridges, but they're also, it's not something that they have to like feel like they're going to step on somebody's toes if they say something. I think it's a place where people can be really transparent, so that helps a lot. I think the folks in New Zealand, I know for most of us, like the Saban Entertainment era really is that where all like the meat of the nostalgia is for the bulk of the fandom, but I do think there's this younger cohort of fans coming up for whom that Saban Brands era and then the Hasbro era will be their nostalgia touch point. And I love a lot of the stuff that's in that section of the book because with a lot of the writers, Alwyn Dale and Becca Barnes especially, they've had such a influence on the franchise and have kind of been, I don't know, other than some of that MNPR Once and Always, some of the like the little behind the scenes video they did for that. I don't know how much people had ever heard from those two. And they were great. Becca, we actually, I wanted to talk with her. I did, there were a few people that I did email interviews with. And so, but what I'd like to highlight her particularly. So when I do email interviews, I usually, I'll email a list of questions and then, you know, ask like, hey, if you say something, and I want to ask another, like some follow-ups, are you cool with that? And, so I asked, I sent her, I don't know, God, 20, 30 questions maybe. And she sent back, it took her like a couple weeks, but she sent back a Google Doc that was like 30 pages long.
Oh, wow.
Answering questions. So,
wow.
She, I mean, it was, I think I had like two follow-ups out of that. I'm like, Becca, you, I mean, you answered these in such a way that I had barely had any follow-ups. So it was, and then Alwyn, me and him talked on the phone for like 5 hours. So,
and you said Alwyn?
Alwyn Dale, yeah.
I think we like mythologize like Judd Lynn, Jackie Rashad, and all those people from the old crew. But I don't think Becca Barnes and Alwyn Dale get enough credit for everything they've done writing. I mean, there's a writer's room, but it's like they're the duo kind of those last few years.
Yeah, and there's a couple other folks who come in there at the MIT and Guy Langford or some other guys. And I didn't really get to chat with them, but Alwyn and Becca are that. I mean, they when you step back, regardless of how you feel about the seasons, I know everybody's got their opinions, and that's cool. But when you step back from it, they're with the show for the last 10, essentially the last 10 years of the show, which is, when you think about it that way, it's like, yeah, we do mythologize the, you know, the Jackies and Chips and folks who were Ann Austin, Doug Sloan, these people that were, I mean, these are people who spent more time on the show than they touched, you know, as many episodes and were spent more time actually in it than a Doug Sloan, for example, which is pretty like, which is weird to say because, you know, those seasons that were touched by some of those folks are obviously iconic. And I think that's something that I'm glad you kind of put it that way because it's easy to get caught up in the emotions of it, especially if you don't like something or you really like something. I think time will help kind of with some of that appreciation and acknowledgement of what those folks gave.
Did you try for Haim?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I tried for everybody. I was, I put a list together of probably 300 or 400 people, just that every using, and John Green's site was a huge help with that. GreenRanger.com, shout out. It's a Green Ranger spelled without the vowels. And he just has a great like cast and crew database. So I was going through that whole thing and, you know, cross-referencing it with stuff and, you know, looking, just making my own list of like, okay, these are never going to happen. These are maybes. These are like essential people, like, and you sort of craft it from there. And that was like early on in my process, just really IDing people. And Haim was like he was like in a whole other category of like not going to happen. He's like not going to happen plus. But I, you know, I reached out, I called his office several times, emailed. I got responses a few times, like people that kind of were kind of back and forth. But I never got the sense that he was ever interested in it.
I guess maybe, you know, the benefit of, you know, being like Sony, like Haim Saban in that case, is there are other like existing interviews to turn to help fill in those blanks, right?
Terry, oh yeah, definitely. And that's where like, you know, some people like that is where like that's where like almost every actor's voice in the book comes from, is from existing quotes, panel interviews. Because actors, I mean, they're the flip side of Haim. Haim is so loaded and so just on another plane of existence for most human beings. He's just untouchable and unreachable. Actors are very reachable, but they have handlers that get in the way and want, I mean, basically like you get stonewalled right at the start, or at least I did. Their agent asked for money and I'm not paying for interviews. Ooh. I'm a journalist. I don't believe in paying for interviews ever in any circumstance. And it kills, you know, cause ultimately, even if I were to pay for an interview, say I broke my moral code and wanted to do that, there's no way to pay for an interview and for me to feel like, even if you're 100% transparent in that interview as the person being interviewed, it doesn't, to me, it's compromised. Like, there's just the
yeah.
And so it got, because it almost was like, oh, I paid you, so you felt like you needed to say something.
Exactly.
You know, kind of scandalous, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm a former journalist. If you, mm-hmm. You know, start giving people money, they're going to want to make you happy.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, it's human nature. And so I get, and I'm also, it's also human nature, like, I respect that people want something for their time, too. So I don't like that people, you know, kind of, that's sort of how things go sometimes, but I understand why it happens. And so, you know, I take that and kind, and what's great about Power Rangers actors is they've done so many interviews over the years, and it also make, you know, the good, what, like, what, it allows you to kind of pick and choose, like, what to, it gets hard, because that's where, if I could have done my own interviews, it helps, like, you can get into stuff, like, that's unclear, but it also adds to the noise, right? Because there's, you can have, probably Austin St. John has talked about, like, the events of leaving the show, 100 different ways, right? You know, and so you kind of have to just kind of consolidate everything the best you can. And again, take perspectives from people who aren't them and really try to write about something like, especially like that. Like, that's really where it's important to sort of absorb everything and then just try to present it as best you can the way that it happened. And also while giving fans maybe some new insight, I think even with that, there's a couple of quotes, like Chip, you've read the book, you know. You know, there's some quotes from Chip about that incident, Chip Lynn, about that incident. And he was a PA, or not a PA, a unit production manager on the set at the time that happened. And so he had some unique insight into that day, kind of like when things started. So,
You've mentioned trying to separate yourself from things like Toys That Made Us and other looks into the history of Power Rangers. Nevertheless, were there elements of those specials that helped kind of send you looking in certain directions in your research?
Totally. I mean, especially with Toys That Made Us, I mean, that's helpful. It's actually, I take some, I don't know, did I take quotes? It's definitely mentioned early on in the book in reference to how the show, the name of the show came together, because that seems to be a that itself seems to be something to me that there's no clear consensus on how, or no, at least no one can come to an agreement on how the name of the show was actually put together. So, which is kind of compelling to me, it seems like, but also totally makes sense, because when that was happening, no one thought this show was going to even get an order. Right. Like,
right. Yeah. I think I've heard the Tony Oliver version where he and another producer, female producer, I think, were pulled aside in the pine pulled aside in the bowling alley, and said, "We're not calling it Dino Rangers. We're calling it Power Rangers." And then the da 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 came later.
Yeah, yeah. Ellen Lovely Sarnoff is
that's right. That's right.
And she's another person that I was able to talk to that hasn't ever really been interviewed about the show that. Was terrific. She had some insights into that's part of the book. She's quoted, because she sort of gets into a little bit of the Morphin, where Morphin came from, possibly. And I say possibly because, again, it's like I kind of present like every little detail as best as it's known, because you know, 30 years,
thirty years,
know,
memories are faulty.
It's you know, I can't remember, you know, I was in Atlanta this weekend and I can barely remember what I ate. You know, some of that's beer, you know, beer memory, but.
So there's a lot of fan folklore, to your point, about things that happen behind the scenes. For example, the walk-off in MNPR. Talk a bit about how the research you did either filled in some of those stories or debunked them.
Yeah, I think it's something when you start talking to so many people. And for me, you know, that there's big names, right? Like your
right.
Chip Lynn's, your Margaret Lesh's. You know, those people are significant players. It's also, though, the people that are lower to the ground that start really giving you some color to things, too. Sound engineers, Baron Abramovich is a guy that was really fun to talk to. Who else? Audie Elod. He's
right,
an editor on the show who just, you kind of really, is a name that I don't think many people really know. And And to some degree, like, there's no reason you should, because I think a lot of times the people know are the people who are out there. You know, the people who are talking or go to panels, and for the most part, that's actors. You know, I think in Power Rangers, we're kind of unique, actually. Our writers and EPs are bigger faces, I think, than a lot of shows, especially kids shows. I could be off base about that, but I don't get the sense that most fandoms have executive producers who have been as involved in conversations over the years at times, at least in the kids, you know, TV space.
I think the producer of Blue's Clues, maybe, I don't know.
No, yeah, maybe. But it's something, so you start gathering those little, you know, not smaller perspectives, but just some insights from people who were there, who didn't, who have never talked about it, because I don't think most people would even think to reach out and talk to these people, because, you know, ultimately, especially, you know, a lot of the stuff we know about those events are from actors, or they're from like little retrospectives online, oral history type things, you know, especially around anniversaries. But those are also most of the time informed by actor interviews. Even though it's, you know, you'll have good journalism done as part of that. It's just, you know, they're not reaching out to the second assistant director to see what might have happened. And that was something I tried to do, and I think I did. I do think I did as great a job. Not again, I'm a pretty harsh self-critic, but especially in terms of the work that was done to just try to make this a really book full of integrity in terms of the facts and everything. To tell the story the most complete and way that it could be, I feel really good about all of that.
Mm-hmm. So let's zoom out a bit. Tell us some more about you. What's your origin story as a fan, particularly joining the online fandom?
Yeah, I was. So I like to, it's on the back of the book. I like to mention my mom, because we're recording right after Mother's Day, so it's a happy Mother's Day to her. But she, I was two when the show premiered, and she says she couldn't ever leave the house when it was on, because I would just throw a tantrum, you know, toddler type tantrum, which is, you know, so I can't confirm that that's how where my fandom started, but I don't think my mom would lie to me. And so from there, though, my earliest memories of actually watching Power Rangers, I'm probably about six or seven, and it's as Turbo, and it's kind of starting Zeo to Turbo, and the but watching reruns of the show, and we had VHS tapes and that sort of thing. And one reason I think that's kind of, I kind of think my mom, I do believe that I was a fan from the beginning, is we did have the original VHS, like the first wave of VHS tapes. Those had to have been bought, you know, probably Christmas of 94, or 93. So it's just funny to think about all of that. And so I keep watching, and then about, you know, it's 98, 99, somewhere in there, we get our first home computer, and and the internet is just like something that I learn exists somehow. And literally the first thing I start doing is looking for Power Ranger stuff, you know, and I end up on RangerCentral.com, and which at the, you know, the predecessor to what is now Ranger Board, that's sort of where Ranger Board at least was birthed out of right. Like a guest book, right? Like one of those, like
we're both dating ourselves here for the mention of the word guest book.
Yeah, it's like I don't even know how I would begin to even describe that to someone who has no, from like a 15-year-old listening.
What's a book?
It was exactly. But so I end up on doing that. You know, I'm just largely a lurker for really, even to now, like I'm largely a lurker more than a poster by far. But man, Ranger Board, I mean, from, you know, that point of it, you know, where I discover it until like I was a freshman in college, I'm no joke, I was like logging into Ranger Board every day. Like, so I was my college freshman year was 2009, and it was RPM was airing, and well, even I guess beyond that, because I was through Samurai like when all that stuff was, so like it's probably 2010, like and stuff like in 2011, like I was from, there was a 12 year 13 year stretch there where I was like literally going to Ranger Board, yeah, at least once a day.
It sounds like there was never a period where, I know for me, I grew out of it for about a year and then returned to it full bore.
Yeah, I know. I never did. And I do think what you, your experience, though, is very common, at least among fans I've spoken to, you know, just over for the book, but also just through the years, that separation period, I think, is pretty common among fans. I'm a weirdo in the sense that I, again, shout out my mom. You know, I was sort of brought up in a way, because I think some people, you know, some people you just maybe lose interest in the show. I do think some people get away from it because they feel like it's kiddie or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was the beginning of Wild Force that alienated me. Like, what are they doing in the jungle? And then I just went found something else to do.
Yeah.
And then why is the mentor a guinea pig a year later?
But yeah, I never left. I never had that separation period. And so, I stuck with it. And, you know, if my mom was someone who told me, if people make fun of you, like, well, you know, strike them back. And so I was kind of brought up that way and never cared about it. And then by the time, though, what was great for me, though, because I may have had that separation period, I like reflecting back on it, going from middle school into high school, just because your life changing a lot. And, you know, I'm from a rural Kentucky town, and where I'm from, there were two middle schools, and then they converge into one high school by the time you're in high school. And so my friend group, you know, from my middle school and for really most of my life through elementary school as well, I kind of hung out with the same people and they were fine or whatever, but I lost that friend group voluntarily, like in high school, because I found my people. I found the nerds, like all the nerds were on the other side of the hill. I just hadn't met them yet. And so it was something that I think, like, I probably would have maybe still stuck with the show, but it certainly made me, like, even feel even more better about, you know, just being who I was.
Now, what makes Power Rangers special in your mind?
To me, it's, I mean, if you wanted to nail it down to one thing, I think it's, you know, I think found family is such a, like, common subject matter, especially in superheroes. You know, like the MCU, everything is sort of revolves around a lot of that found family aspect. But for me, and maybe there's a lot of media that predates that, but for me, like, that's a huge part of Power Rangers. But it's not just the found family aspect; it's the diversity of that family, the inclusivity of Power Rangers is such a, you can't. Like, I don't care if you're somebody who just is anti-DEI or whatever. Why are you watching Power Rangers? Like, it isn't baked into the show. It is the show. I mean, it really is something that matters a ton when you're talking about coming together for a common objective and teamwork and the earnestness of it all is what's really, maybe when you roll all that together, and this the sincerity of it is maybe what even maybe separates Power Rangers the most from most superhero media and a lot of media in general, is that, you know, it's never shied away from just being what it is, and really for better or worse, because I think maybe some fans might argue towards the end of the you know, Saban Brand / Hasbro era, you know, as you age, you maybe there's a school of thought, at least for some people, you want your media to age up with you, or you want to have multiple offerings. Like, I think for, like, again, the MCU, so the movies are PG-13, you know, teenage kind of young adult level, you know, mentality. And then you have cartoons like, you know, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Like, that's for the 4-year-olds. And Power Rangers never, you know, I think the 2017 movie is kind of the only example of that. The comic books, to a lesser extent, are that. But the show really stayed in that 3 to 8-year-old range for its entire run. And, you know, I think that's kind of cool. I think it's cool that it tried to be a great way to show kids around the world, like, you can be part of a superhero team and you can work with people who don't look anything like you or don't act like anything like you, and y'all can come together and do something really awesome.
So, kind of alluded to this, but after your book was already locked and off the printing press, etc., we got some developments about a show apparently close to happening with the showrunners of Percy Jackson. First off, how much did that frustrate you that you weren't able to include this stuff in your book?
That was incredibly frustrating, and even more so because I was able to kind of make some adjustments on the fly. Really, I was very lucky. Like, I was able to work in the in-whistle stuff had sort of fallen apart. Like, I was able to
right,
kind of
exactly
get into that
too. That happened too.
And so there was enough time between when the book went to press and in the editing process that I was still able to make a really last minute change like that. So I'm like, okay, I felt really good. Cause when that happened, I was like, okay, surely nothing is going to drop about Power Rangers between now and then. And then literally 3 weeks before, you know, press, like it, or 4 weeks, whatever it was when that dropped, like last month, it's like, oh damn it. But you know what, you also accept that, because when you write, somebody who was also helped me along this process was Daniel, a guy named Daniel Dockery. He wrote a book, a pretty similar book about Pokemon, and you know, again, Pokemon, like Power Rangers, it's something like, there's always, like, Pokemon's, it's an evergreen franchise, like it's something that's always, there's always going to be something significant for happening and a big development happening within the franchise. And he dealt with some of some similar things. And the way he sort of worked around that is, a large part of his book is really framed around his personal experience with the franchise and in kind of ending in that Hoenn, you know, Generation 3. I don't know how much you know about Pokemon. It doesn't matter. But, like, the way I dealt with it is, like, okay, I'm wrapping up. I'm sort of spitting, like, I'm kind of spitballing a little bit, like, what the future of the franchise could look like, more on a really high-level form. Like, I'm talking, like, oh, maybe, you know, Power Rangers won't even be a TV show in the future. It might be TikTok, you know, a TikTok series or something, you know. And obviously, I couldn't have seen, like, the TikTok band coming or anything like that. So, you're getting into some dicey area once you start doing that. But it's more so just kind of, for me, it was as important, as much as I would have liked to include, like, a beat-by-beat, the most recent thing possible. Right. It's more about, like, okay, these last few pages, I want people to come away from this experience feeling just really, like, in awe of the show that they love. Like, we all love Power Rangers, but I don't, it's hard to maybe step back and appreciate, like, really what it has given us. Even if it never gives us anything else, I think that's the key, is, you know, even if the Power Rangers is over for good, and I don't ever think that's the case, but if it was, like, man, like, what a ride, you know?
So, to kind of wrap it up, for people who think they know everything about Power Rangers, including, like, the people who listen to this probably,
yeah,
tell them
yeah.
why you think they should get your book.
I think you should buy my book. Even if you think you know everything about Power Rangers, I do think even the hardest core, deep in the wikis and deep in Ranger Board and, you know, been through all the fandom drama, whatever, watched every episode, I do think there'll be something. I do think there'll be something you'll learn, just or if nothing else, a perspective on something that you've never seen before, because I interviewed and so many people who had never talked and dug into some research. Like, I think there were articles I'd clipped from newspapers.com that had never been touched before, you know, outside of my interaction with them and you know, these old, just and broadcasting and cable, that's another one I should have mentioned. Their archive is freaking incredible. It was an industry trade magazine that kind of went out to TV affiliates. It wasn't for fans or the general public. It was for network executives, and it was like a B2B magazine, and that was an incredible resource for some of the historical stuff. So yeah, I think, and if so, so say you are the person that just somehow that doesn't move the needle. You did know everything. I think the story is well told. I think, again, I'm a harsh critic. I don't, you know, I look back on things I wrote. You know, I still, you know, do some newspaper writing. I wrote some things 2 months ago for the newspaper that I look back and I'm poking holes in stories I wrote 2 months ago. I think there's, you know, I will say there's some, I've already caught like one, it's not a typo, it is a typo, but it's a misspelling, that I thought I'd caught every one of those. And it's Hip Hop Keto. I used a second D like five or six pages after, it's early on. It's like in chapter two, and I'm like, shit.
Yeah, but kind of obsessing over it. It's relatable. I get it.
But so far that's the only thing I've caught. So if I get through the entire book and there's only one little extra D on Hip Hop Keto, I think I can eat it. I'll be okay. But I think the story's well told. I think it's like the way I've organized it, and I think, and why I say that, especially like I think it's, you know, I'm comfortable saying that I think it's well written, being the person that wrote it. I cried at things I wrote every time I read the book. Like, you know, I had to edit. I've read this thing cover to cover. It's been hard for me to want to read through the entire print thing. I've got my copies, because I've read this thing like 20 times, you know, like probably more than that, you know. And but there's certain, every time I hit certain moments in the book, and I think if you're a longtime fan, they might not affect somebody as much if you're someone who, you know, is just picking up the book and you want to learn about Power Rangers, or you like TV history and you just want to kind of learn. But I think for fans, there are for sure two, and I think I would say three big moments in the book that I hope you cry. Like I really that would make me happy, because I was crying. I've cried every time I've read. I cried when I wrote them, you know, because of just the emotional weight that they hold for Power Rangers fans.
So I mentioned Ranger Reader. Where else can people find your stuff?
Yeah, my website, joshuamoore.com, is just a good holding spot for everything. That's where all my socials are, if you want to find those, or my email address is there. And, you know, I should get around to posting more of my general writing. I don't do a good job of updating that stuff. I'm on Blue Sky. That's probably, like, social media-wise where I'm most active. Again, my website, joshuamoore.com, is my handle on Blue Sky, so that's pretty just convenient. And outside of that, Ranger Reader's a good resource. I do need to write there more. I would like to do that more. It's just, you know, it's hard. I have a day job and you know, trying to promote the book and doing that stuff. So most of my writing on Ranger Reader lately has been revolved around promoting the book. But I would like to get, you know, back in the routine of doing more. You know, it's never been like a heavy newsletter. So I think that's an appeal if you're out there and you're like, man, I don't want three newsletters in my email inbox again. You know, three more in my each week. But you know, at my best, I might be sending out one a month or a couple a month. So I think it's if you like Power Rangers and want to just kind of. And I try to keep my writing too. I don't, you know, I'm not doing like news updates or there's plenty of people that are doing that way better than I am. For me, I want it to be additive and more, you know, analysis and bigger, you know, feature type stuff.
So the author is Joshua Moore. The book is More Phenomenal: How the Power Rangers Conquered the World. You can find it on bookshelves everywhere May 20th. Josh, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. If you like what you just heard, find us at rangercast.net or look us up in your favorite podcast app. And be sure to leave a review. That's the best way to help more people discover the show. You can also find us on X, Facebook, and now Blue Sky. Our opening theme is by Daniel Park. The ending theme is by me. RangerCast is distributed under Creative Commons license. Attribute and share alike.